Coming to you from Orange County, California, this is the Jug Life Podcast with Max Ada and Chad Wesley Smith.
All right, welcome to a very special episode of the Jug Life Podcast. I'm very excited about this one. We're in the Hudson Field House at Witter Rugby Field at the University of California, Berkeley, joined today by Jack Clark, head rugby coach for the University of California Golden Bears rugby team. Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us today. Yeah. I'll toot his horn for him. Maybe I could have phrased that better. But Jack Clark has been the head rugby coach here since 1984. In that time, the Cal Golden Bears rugby team has won 28 national championships, 23 in the 15s and 5 in rugby sevens. So for the 15s, that's 23 out of 33 seasons. So batting a little bit more than than two-thirds. So pretty good average there when it comes to winning national championships. Has produced 135 All-Americans during that time. It's about 4 per year. And against U.S. competition, the program has had winning streaks of 115 games, 98 games, 70 games, and 63 games. So you could say Cal Rugby under Jack Clark has been doing pretty good. And a very impressive thing. And the what stuck out to me as wanting to come and do this episode with him, as a student here at Berkeley on the track team, my first track team meeting here. I'd been here maybe a week in my freshman year, and our coach brought Coach Clark in as a guest speaker. And some of you have probably read this article on my website talking about this, but you talked about your kind of mantra for the rugby team here: grateful for everything, entitled to nothing. And that's something that's stuck with me for the last 14 years since I heard it. What does that mean, and what's that mean to Cal Rugby?
Yeah. If you have a set of values, if there's a bunch of things that you believe in that you're willing to fight for, I think there's an access point to those values. And I think it's through a mindset. So there's an architecture, if you will, to the culture. And that's our mindset. Our mindset is that we're grateful for everything, entitled to nothing. We reckon there's not enough true gratitude in the world. And we do believe there's probably too much entitlement. So it just seems like the right thing to do. And then ultimately, that mindset allows the team to be very resilient. You know, when you don't believe that you're owed something and you're truly thankful for everything that you get, you become a more resilient, probably tougher competitor.
And that resilience and toughness is something, of course, that's paramount to success in rugby. But with what we're dealing with, weightlifters, powerlifters, and our main audience, I think that's going to be something that's hugely important to them too. Especially as we look at the growth of weightlifting in the United States over the last 5 years in particular, there's become so much more support and everything for the athletes. It would be simple for a lot of them to now feel some sense of entitlement to that they deserve, this stipend or that kind of thing. Where, when Max was competing in weightlifting, lifting, squatting 10-30 max singles a week in a negative 30 degrees in a garage in Montana, you guys certainly weren't entitled to anything at that point.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that when Chad first said that, when I first saw that, the entitled to nothing and grateful for everything, it seemed like, it resonated with me because it was so much what we started with, where the sport had nothing in it, right? So you don't feel like you deserve anything. And so we were grateful for those opportunities to just go into the gym and have a gym. I mean, to even have bars and bumpers back then. But I think that's kind of, that's definitely, those lines I think are blurred a lot now in the current climate of some of the weightlifting in this country, at least from our perspective.
All sports, I'm sure.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, I'm all sure sports. It's, yeah.
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 So you've been able to create, you know, all the stats I listed off, a great culture of winning here. And certainly the grateful for everything and tell the nothing goes to that. What are some other, you know, big keys as you build team culture and this culture of success?
I think that when you lay out whatever, however you refer to them, your pillars, your values, your beliefs, I think they create a system, and that system it's important that it's not, these aren't like sayings on the gym wall, you know, meant to, wow, that yeah. sounds great, right? This is in effect what you're going to measure. This is what you're going to celebrate when you get it right. These values in combination create a system, and they're there to process all the transactions, all the business transactions and organizational transactions and human transactions that you have on your team through this value system. So at the end of the day, you know, you're making value-based decisions that you're proud of, right? It doesn't make, sometimes they're still hard. There's a lot of hard decisions that have to be made, but they can be made in a way that, you know, respects the organization, respects the individuals within the organization, and really creates a value proposition.
So, you know, I went through a lot of other interviews and everything, really as many as I could find before coming with you here today, and there was a couple of these sayings that stuck out to me. So if you could elaborate on these ideas for me. The idea of loving conditionally.
Yeah. I mean, it started a few years ago, maybe 10 or so years ago. I realized that every time I opened my sports page, there was another sports team calling themselves a family. And I think I knew what they meant. I mean, I think what they were saying is they cared about each other. And I reckon that's really important. You know, the notion that if we care about each other, that somehow all the hard work and this whole journey is going to get richer. That just made total sense to me. And maybe it's just semantics, but as I start thinking really about family, I mean, what I know about family is it's unconditional, right? I mean, you know, that's... You know, sometimes your family is a little screwed up, but they're still your family and you love them, right? But that's not what high-performance teams are about. High-performance teams are not unconditional. In fact, they're highly, highly conditional. And teams in all walks of life, all businesses that you really admire, that are really businesses that that have achieved over a long period of time, and athletic teams that have achieved over a long period of time, that consistently achieve, what you find is they have really, really stringent conditions. This is how we do things here. And when people get outside of those parameters, they're really outside of the organization itself. So conditional versus unconditional, I think at some point we have to make friends with the fact that, and maybe this is even more of a challenge for millennials possibly, is that we have to, you know, we got to make friends with there's going to be conditions. And ultimately we want those conditions in this particular organization. And then outside of the organization, outside of that high performance organization, you know, when we're in family, that's probably unconditional, right? I mean, you know, we're gonna, right's right, wrong's wrong, but we're gonna go about it in a far different way. We're not gonna separate from each other, for example, right? And that happens all the time in high performance athletics.
I think it's that creating those certain expectations in which that conditional love is given, it's going to, I think, cause people to rise to that expectation, or for you to be able to identify that this person isn't going to rise to it and they're not loved conditionally anymore.
If you ever shower, brush your teeth, or try to make your hair look presentable, generally just trying to make yourself not look like a ragamuffin, I've got good news for you. Dollar Shave Club has a lot of stuff to help you out. As you may have noticed, I am a handsomely rugged, bearded man, but what Dollar Shave Club has goes far beyond razors. They have the One Wipe Charlies to keep you clean where you really need to be clean, and the Amber Lavender Body Cleanser. It's going to keep you smelling fresh. So they've got everything you need to get ready in the bathroom, much more than just razors. Dollar Shave Club, yes, that Dollar Shave Club delivers everything you need to look, feel, and smell your best. You name it, shampoo, conditioner, body wash, toothpaste, hair gel, even a wipe that'll leave your tush feeling tingly clean. If it can help a gentleman of advanced size as myself get such a hot girlfriend, it's probably worth it to check it out. I'm a big fan of their amber and lavender calming body cleanser. Never smelled anything like it. Good luck finding a product that great at the store. And all of Dollar Shave Club's products are made with top shelf ingredients that won't break your budget. You'll feel the difference. Plus, shipping is free with your membership. Here's a great way to try a bunch of Dollar Shave Club's products. For just $5, you can get their Daily Essentials Starter Set. It comes with body cleanser, One Wipe Charlies, their amazing butt wipes, their world famous shave butter, and their best razor, the Six Blade Executive. Keep the blades coming for a few more bucks a month. Add in shampoo, toothpaste, or anything else you need. Check it all out at dollarshaveclub.com/juglife. That's dollarshaveclub.com/juglife.
The next one, you talk about accountability and how creating accountability within your program here has helped you guys be successful.
Yeah, I mean, I think in all successful organizations, you know, having the participants, having the team members, you know, feel accountable really to each other is what it's about. And you've got to kind of get over yourself, right? And like, we value selflessness as the actual value, you know, and that's, you know, what we say is team first, self last. And again, that it's not meant to be a cute saying. It's meant to be a declaration that that's how we're going to make all the decisions here, right? So when it really gets difficult, what we're going to do is the first lens that's going to come down is what's best for the team, and that's how we're going to make decisions. Now, obviously, if somebody, you know, has some trauma in their life and they need us, you know, we're always going to put our arms around people, right? We're always going to come to them when they're really needed. But the routine day-to-day decisions of the team, of the organization, is always what's best for the organization first. And in some ways, it's an easy declaration to give, right? It's the sleeves off your vest, if you will, because we have a fiduciary responsibility to do that. And all we're really doing is just saying it out loud, just having the courage to say it out loud. Here's how we're going to do it. The decisions that we make are going to be what's best for the team. That's the organization you're a part of. And sometimes, as individuals, we come second to that decision.
And so many of these, you know, kind of different axiom mantra stuff, as you were saying, they can't just be, you know, painting on the gym wall. And that's probably what really sets it apart from, you know, anyone can come up with fun, you know, motivational sayings.
Yeah,
but to actually put into practice and live them on a daily basis, and when there is a tough decision, I think you see something like this with you know, the New England Patriots,
sure.
And they make these personnel decisions that maybe they love this player and he did all this great stuff, but he is no longer the, you know, the necessary component to the team, and they have to put Robert Kraft or Bill Belichick has to put a personal bias aside in that, and it is a tough thing to do, and for me as a business owner, you know, I've had to make those type of decisions, and sometimes I've done a good job of it, and sometimes I've waited too long on it and done a poor job of it, but this next one I think is hugely important in being a good coach and creating a system, an effective system. And we've talked about this, that in American weightlifting, so much of it is trying to copy, well, this is what Russia does, this is what China does, let's do it like them, rather than creating an American system. And a big part of creating this American system is this next idea. Talk about creating a shared vocabulary.
Yeah. I mean, organizationally, we need a glossary. You know, when we're going to use any phrase, mental toughness. If we're actually going to say mental toughness, organizationally, it's important that we're all thinking the same thing. It means the same thing to us. Now, you know, it's possible that you can have different views of that, but within the tent of the team, when we use that word, we're going to use our glossary definition of that word so that we're all clear what it means. And as an example, just to kind of bring that home, you know, we would say mental toughness is an ability. You know, you're not born with it. You know, it's a skill. It's like any other thing that we work on over time and we acquire. And we say it's the ability to focus on the next most important thing. Now just think about that. So when do you have to access mental toughness? Well, when things are pear-shaped, when they're bad, when things aren't going well. No one has to access mental toughness when everything's going great, right? And when things are going bad, our ability to go to the next most important thing, to not live in what just happened, not to worry about what it's going to mean in the future or later on, but just go, what is the next most important thing and how do I put my focus and my energy on the next most important thing? It's a great discipline, a great skill. Now, we believe that organizationally. And when we say mental toughness, that's what we're talking about. And so it becomes imperative that we have that glossary, because if we went around the room, I mean, there's 55 boys in the team, right? If we went around the room and said, what's the definition of mental toughness day one, and no one had been a part of us, I mean, we'd get 20 guys in, we'd have 20 different answers, and they'd all be valid to a certain degree. It becomes really important, I think, that organizationally, that you actually put some stuff down on paper, you write it down, and you play with it over time, and you let it marinate, and you share it with others, and you get their input. So at some point, we know what we're talking about. And this is true also beyond a glossary. It's true in, you know, what analysis do we use, right? I mean, I get a big kick out of, you know, I mean, the media a lot has decided what our analysis is in so many sports, as opposed to the coach deciding that this is what I want to measure, this is what I want to focus on, because I believe this is the key to success in a given event, in a given sport. And that becomes proprietary, right? I mean, that becomes proprietary to a team. So we have to know what are those things that we believe is really important, and we have to stat those things. I mean, I work with a couple of basketball coaches, and I get a kick out of it, right? So if the ball bounces off the rim and some guy gets it flat-footed, it's called a rebound. It hits the stat sheet as a rebound. Meanwhile, some guy goes up in the paint with some big guy on his back, and they go up once, twice. On the third time with a guy hanging over him, he gets the rebound. I go, what's that called? And I call it a rebound. I'm going, that makes no sense, right? Those are two different acts. They ought to have different. So if you want guys to actually, you know, get whatever you want to call that thing, with those contested, really hard moments in sport, then call it something different, stat it, and celebrate. It's amazing the effect that would have on the team.
Next one. This one strikes me because it in some ways almost seems counterintuitive. The idea of expecting everyone to lead.
Yeah. And it's a bit provocative, right? Because I think what's happened is that authority has hijacked leadership, right? I mean, they're the same thing, right? Are the people with all the authority, well, they're our leaders, right? So the coach is the leader. The star player is the leader. The businessman in the corner office with the best title, he's the leader. And I think if you unpack that, you say, well, what's everyone else then? Followers. Ooh, well, that don't sound that good to me, right? And that's the old minority leads the majority thing. So I just think it takes it. It requires more treatment than that. Like, so here's what I'm not saying. Like, I believe in chain of command. I believe in it. I think if we lose chain of command, we don't have a prayer. I mean, we have to have the ability to point all of our noses in the same direction at a key point and then go execute, right? So chain of command is important, but there's no reason for chain of command to hijack leadership. They're two different things. Authority is authority, right? That's a grave responsibility, and it should just stay there. Now, we want the star player, we want the coach, we want the executives in business. We want them to be good leaders, but we want other people to be good leaders as well, right? That's my view. I don't subscribe to within the confines of leadership, I don't subscribe to the majority, the minority leads the majority. So we've changed the definition. I mean, to us, leadership, by way of definition, is the ability to make those around you better and more productive. Full stop. That's it. You don't have to be the boss to do that, right? You can be the newest member of the organization. If you can make people around you better and more productive, if you have that ability, And again, you're not born with it. This is a skill. You acquire this over time with work. Then, you know, it's going to be powerful. And the more people that are trying to make the people around them better and more productive, that doesn't mean they get to make all the decisions. It just means that leadership is different than authority. And that when we treat it that way, when we actually subscribe to this notion that we expect everyone to lead, interestingly, you can require it. Now, think about an organization where you have a lot of people contributing to the middle because they feel it's their responsibility to do so. I have a responsibility here to make those around me better and more productive. Sometimes that's just don't be a distraction, right? This is about how big your toolbox is at the end of the day. This is where, you know, if all you can do is, if you only got a hammer in there and you can just yell at people, well, there's going to be a time when you're right, but, you know, maybe you keep quiet the other times. But the people that have these expansive toolboxes that really can, you know, they have the ability to, when somebody's had a bad day, to authentically put their hand on their shoulder and say, it's going to get better. We've all been where you are right now. Come on, man, just come with us. It's going to be good, right? That's great. And that same guy to have the ability to be able to look a teammate in the eye that you care about and say, your best can be better. You can be a better player for us, right? And to be able to do both of those things, to get out in front when it's hard to be in front, when it's difficult there. And then when it's easy to be in front, maybe to push others there in front, right? So I just think that leadership is one of those things that's been hijacked, and I want to unhijack it. Right? I want to say that we believe in authority. We need bosses. You know, we need people in authority to make these decisions and to not do what we're really asking. They're asking at any one point in time. That's mutiny. It's not okay, right? But they don't have to take leadership with them. We can say leadership is something that that the newest person to our organization has, all the way to our star players.
And all of this stuff is something you've clearly put a ton of thought into. What are some resources, you know, whether it's books or speakers to listen to, podcasts, whatever it is, that you would suggest for people looking to improve in these areas could seek out?
You know, I think the performance gurus out there, the Jim Lehrers of the world, the Michael Gervais of the world, I mean, those guys are pretty special. I mean, they're... Every once in a while, I think I really believe in something, and I run it by them, and then they show me, well, that's actually real strong social science, and they explain it to me that I didn't invent it, and that I've just stumbled across something that most people know about, and so I think those are the stars, and you've pointed to, you know, organizations like the Patriot. I mean, I have a chance to be embedded this summer, right? It's a long shot that I'm working on, but it looks really good. I can't wait for that opportunity. I've had a lot of shadowing opportunities with great coaches, and you know, you want to learn from those people that have these iconic bits of success in all walks of life, really. And it's reassuring, I think, study. You know, I think the study of people that have that authority, that are leading organizations, and the people that and those organizations that are routinely successful, and those teams that are routinely successful, I think we learn from all those. But it's also reassuring when you really, I think, submerge yourself in study of them. I think what you find is that, you know, they're not as iconic as you thought. It's not like they check every box. It's typically they have a brilliance in a couple areas that really carries them to great personal success. And that the really great organizations, there might not be any one individual there that checks all the boxes, but together, really, you know, leveraging each other, they do check all the boxes. So I would encourage people to study. I would encourage, if you care about it. I mean, now this is... And consider this, right? I mean, so I work at this university. It's a world-class research institution, and team isn't taught here anywhere, right? I mean, so I think that, you know, my guess is that, you know, there's an ROTC program or something, and I'm sure there's moments where students are working in collaboration on a project or something, but that's not team the way we know team, right? And I just think it's such a valuable thing to study. I mean, what do they say, 10,000 hours or 10 years to be an expert in something, right? And I mean, so many people that participate in sport, for example, get there. You know, they pass that milestone. And I wonder if they really take away, if they're paying enough attention to really take away and be proud of the fact that they are an expert in team now. They do know what the makings of a good team look and feel like, and they know what a good teammate is like. And obviously, over time, they're going to know what bad teams and how they operate and what, you know, why they're bad and what a bad teammate looks and feels like and what it, and the effects that has on a team. And I think through that study, I mean, think about, you know, I don't think we're like one bright person away from solving the big problems, right? I mean, whatever they are, the environment, education, just go ahead, disease, rip through all the big things that we have to solve now. And it's going to be groups of people. So, therefore, the lessons that, you know, your readers and your lesson and listeners are getting in team, that positively affects their experiences. But more importantly than that, it positively affects their families and their communities and their workplaces. I just can't imagine anything more valuable to study than team and culture.
Fantastic.
Wow. Yeah, very much.
Max, questions?
there's a lot there. Yeah. This is fantastic. Yeah, I can't think of anything. I'm just trying to process it all.
Yeah, I think that's perfect. Perfect place to end. So normally we ask where people can follow our guests on social media, but I don't feel like that's as big of a deal as what you're doing.
Yeah, I'm not, you know, yeah. Jack Clark Rugby, you know, is you can follow me there a bit, but I'm fine. I'm trying to follow others is what I'm trying to do. I'm not following myself.
Do you have any books or any kind of?
No, I mean, it's in the future, right? I'm gonna tell everything, you know, at some point. I mean, it's great to share though, right? I mean, it's such a beautiful thing when people share with me and allow me to learn from them. And you know, I feel an obligation to pay that forward and tell people everything I think I know. And there was a time when I think I spent the first 20 years of my career being really guarded about what I thought I knew, just because I was competitive. And that's not the right way to go about it, right? I mean, I've had so many, you know, when I reflect, even during that period, there were so many people being generous with me. You know, the idea that I was hoarding that information and hoarding all that valuable data was crazy. So I don't do it anymore. I'm happy to tell anybody anything I think I know, and if it helps them, great.
Wow. Awesome. All right, so this is Jack Clark, head coach, Cal Golden Bear Rugby. All the national championships you can win, they've done it, and I think you can see a lot of why that's happening from this kind of leadership. So if you like the Jug Life, go on iTunes and give us a 5-star review. Helps more people find us. And thanks so much for taking the time, Coach.
Yeah, my pleasure. Cheers.
Go Bears.
Go Bears.